this is Pearl Lamb Podcast. Now, today I'm in Miami. I'm here with one of my favorite people, Dawn Amira Rubel. Here, I'm in their home, and it's, look at it, paintings everywhere. So now, Dawn Amira, I think most of there's many audience who is not from and from the art world. Can you briefly talk about you and the Rubel Museum and your Rubel collection? About you.
Where do we begin? We have to begin what?
We're married about 60 years and we've been collecting about 59 years and 11 months. So we can't say we always collected.
There's no anecdote for this addiction.
I think everybody who comes to Miami, the first thing that they would love to see is the Rubel Museum. And it's really breathtaking, especially yesterday. I mean, I haven't been here for 10 years. And when I went to your new museum, I was flabbergasted. Now, one of the questions I always want and one I want to ask, I know you got married, and during your first year of marriage, you start collecting. I mean, when you met, you two shared the interest, the passion in art?
No, absolutely not.
Then how did it all start?
Well, it started, Dawn was a medical student.
I know. Yeah.
And I was a teacher, Head Start teacher. Yeah. And he was medical school. I was teaching and taking a master's degree in education at that time. And we were just busy studying all the time. But we managed to take long walks to just break up the study.
Dating.
Well, we're already married.
We're married
because we were married the whole time. Because we got married in August. He started medical school in September. So we were married the whole time through his entire medical school.
But
he was a mathematician first, then he decided to go to medical school. It's a long story.
But the neighborhood we lived in has now become Tribeca.
I see.
At that time, it really wasn't. But it was during a recession in the city, and the artists were able to rent storefront.
Where they lived and worked.
And when we would study, we would every 2 or 3 hours we'd take a break and walk around the neighborhood and we would run into various artists.
I see.
So we started experiencing, we had no money, I was earning $100 a week. But on zero money, we found a universe of talent and brilliant people who engaged us and challenged us with the work they were doing.
So every day you're walking past, you're seeing the studios, you're seeing the artists working. So you went and visited them, you started a conversation with them?
So one day we knocked on them.
No, that's not how it done. It was one person smoking outside that said, "Why don't you come in and see my studio?"
Really?
Okay. There were other doors that we knocked. But this, I remember, so some detail, it's 60 years ago.
Oh my God.
So yeah, it was, the first artist was smoking outside because they were living illegally and working in these storefronts. Oh. So we entered the space and it literally opened a universe to us. Because imagine walking off a street into seeing extraordinary artwork being made right there.
So then what happened is we loved it and we went back another time and another time and another time. And then he turned to us finally and said, "Don't you think you really should buy a painting of ours?" And I think Mira said, "We'd love to, but I make $100 a week and he doesn't earn anything." He said, "That's all right, pay it off over time."
So that was the voila moment where we realized that a payment plan
could be arranged.
And the artist was delighted. It started a relationship. We were there every week
him the punchline, though. He finally said, "Well, what can you afford?" We said, $5 a week. He said, "Okay." I think that artists were so lonely in these days that he was happy to have someone come every week.
Yes, of course.
No, but you know what? Even at $5 a week, it paid off $100 drawing. It paid off. And of course, the numbers got bigger and bigger. And I can report that to this day, We wouldn't have this collection if it wasn't for the generosity
of
the artists, of the gallerists working with us on continuous payment plans.
Actually,
I think collectors.
Yes, exactly.
Actually, in 60 years, we've only had 1 week where we didn't owe the art world money. And we were so uncomfortable that week that we immediately went out and bought
something. I remember correctly, the beautiful collection of Chinese art that we have from you was always on a very generous payment plan.
Of course. You know, to be in your collection, I think it's the honor of all the artists and us as well. I mean, to working with you is delightful. But I love the way how you go in, you looked at it, within, you know, you have... That time, Jason wasn't there. You two discussed. Short time, you know what you want. I mean, it takes confidence. Now, another question, which I hope that it will inspire all the young collectors, because it really, you need balls and you need confidence to know what you want. All right. You go in and you went to one artist's place. You look at the paintings for several weeks and you know what you want. And you're confident?
We actually don't know what we want. We don't even know what we're looking for. It's not like we're,
to this
we
day.
Know. It's not like we walk in and we know what we're looking for. That's. I think that it's
no,
about
but,
the
match. Let me touch you.
There is something happens when we walk, when we see something that intrigues us. Something, there's some chemical reaction that happens. And of course, in our case, the chemical reaction has to be the both of us, and often Jason is there too. Now we traveled
with the
two
together.
Of us, and we also traveled with Jason. So you know there is a reaction between the two of us and the three of us, and it is a mystery how that all works. I can't say that it's...
I'll go back with Jason and how you all work.
Yeah.
And I've personal witness for 2 weeks about all the dynamics. But going back, because today... Many of the collectors, they don't look at the art to feel it. They look at the numbers. They look at the auction result. So you guys were buying from your heart. I mean, don't you find that nowadays the world has changed? Many, many collectors, they don't buy from the heart.
I think no matter what the reason someone starts collecting, it's such an incredibly seductive
process. But it takes a lot of confidence.
But after a while, they learn to buy from their heart.
I think people get eventually seduced. But there are those people that come to... That art has become such a global economy in a way, too, that you're definitely going to have people who start or are attracted to its economics, you know?
Absolutely.
But like Don said, I think... It's powerful enough to seduce eventually. And if you don't get seduced, your children will become seduced all of a sudden your children will think you're very, very cool for collecting art. And you're like kind of surprised. Wow, I was just thinking of making a buck out of a painting, but all of a sudden my children think that's very cool that I have this artwork. But it's I think people come to art for many different reasons, and I don't think I'm not particularly interested in judging
the
them.
The eventual.
I think ultimately, if people dig into what makes art, I think it's very seductive on an emotional level, on a human level.
So go back to your good old days. So after the first artist, then you start going around the Tribeca and looking at different artists.
We continue looking. I think for 60 years we've been looking and looking and looking and never stopping.
Well, looking and reading and studying and communicating. And, of course, our greatest source of information is from fellow artists.
I love one story you both told me about going to Jeff Koons, and then you have to carry your own artwork down. Can you repeat that and how you give up one of the artwork because it was too heavy?
Jeff Koons was something else. Jeff Koons had his first exhibition he made himself, and it's right across the street from a men's clothing store in New York called Bonnie's.
Downtown.
And he rented downtown, and he rented this apartment, not even a loft, on the second floor, maybe even the third floor. And he showed his, he called afterwards his pre-new pieces, which were brand new appliances with lights behind them. And
appliances like washing machine. It was a washing machine, a dryer.
And then you got a Hoover.
A Hoover, right.
But the most dangerous one is he had a refrigerator. And we really liked this refrigerator, and we told him we'd be happy to take it. He said, okay,
take it.
Take it. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, it's kind of like cash and carry. You have to carry the refrigerator.
No, it was, we didn't end up, it didn't happen.
I know, because
at that time, we wouldn't have had a place to even put it.
I remember Don was telling the story as, how can I carry this refrigerator down the stairs?
We tried, but we weren't even able to get it out of the room.
Listen, there was one time where we bought a sculpture in California that came to our house, and the only place that it could fit was to take over our entire living room. So we actually got rid of all the living room furniture and put the sculpture in. Eventually, of course, we lost our furniture. We've lost rooms in our house to accommodate art. That's why eventually we ended up, we feel very fortunate to have, found the kind of space that you saw in Allopatha. You know, 100,000 square feet where we can take our imagination.
And now you also have a museum in Washington.
Yes. It took almost 16 years to make that happen because it was a dilapidated, abandoned junior high school. And it meant a lot to the neighborhood because it was a historical black boys junior high school where Marvin Gaye attended, where some teacher in that school said, Marvin, you're going to be somebody someday. That's why our first show was called What's Going On?
Which
the whole world knew. So, and what's going on? Coincidentally, we had a work by Keith Haring, and he dedicates this work to Don's brother. But he said, I was making this work listening to Marvin Gaye over and over again to What's Going On. So it was in the first show we had the Keith Haring, What's Going On, the artwork that he made listening to Marvin Gaye's music.
And we had Marvin Gaye's music in the background.
Yes.
And I remember last night you were telling me that, and that museum was an old school, right? And each of the schoolroom, you have an installation or classroom.
It's perfect. Schoolrooms make the best galleries. I don't know why people waste time building galleries.
I know. Old schools are perfect. So it's they're old class.
Walls.
They're classrooms, and they're teachers. In those days, a classroom would also have a teacher's office next to it,
a much smaller
space. But each classroom had a teacher's office, and the combination of the larger class size of the classroom and the intimate space of the teachers creates wonderful spaces for all sorts of intimate presentations of the art.
But not so intimate in some pretty big installations.
No, and small. It creates a very interesting dynamic between larger spaces and smaller spaces to show the art.
So in New York, you were, at the time when you were collecting art, it was really the scene, all the artists, the great artist scene has moved to America, and they were all in New York, right?
I wouldn't say they moved there. I think they lived there.
That's
not true. Actually, you're right. A lot of the young people
in America would go to New York
because it was the place where you could be free and express yourself. There was no way that Keith Haring was going to be Keith Haring in Potsdam, Pennsylvania. So it was a place where you came to be free, a place to express yourself, a place to join with other people like yourself to explore life. And it was a very, very dynamic moment, a dangerous moment, I might add.
Yeah, at the time, when I was reading about New York, it was dangerous.
Well, no, it was more dangerous economically than physically. Yeah, I don't think we were ever threatened physically, but there was too much good art.
Well, I don't know. I mean,
New York went bankrupt, right?
People lost faith in the city, and there was a sense that New York was dangerous. But that's why when these artists, there was a scene happened in New York where it was a place to be with other creative people. And we happened to be there at that moment.
I remember we had one 2-month period where we found Cindy Sherman, Robert Longo, Jack Goldstein.
Richard Prince.
Richard Prince, all in a one-month period.
How do you afford to buy all of them?
No, well,
we don't.
Well, first of all, Cindy was 200.
On time.
Wait, Cindy on time. But Cindy was $200.
Even at that time.
Oh, she was $50. I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. It was $50.
$50.
The Cindy Sherman that we had was $50. Her, you know, classic piece was $50. Jean Michel was $1,500, which we bought on a payment plan. We went into Anina Nosai's basement. This was 1981.
Right.
Because Keith, who we met earlier, told us that the most talented person on the face of the earth right now was his friend Jean-Michel Basquiat.
So that means that the artist would introduce you to other artists.
Exactly, which still goes on to this day.
Yeah.
So when Keith told us that he had this extraordinary talented friend that we had to meet, he said, well, go to Anina Nosai's gallery. She gave him a space in the basement.
Right.
So when we arrived, we said, Keith sent us to see this artist. She said, what artist? She basically was trying to keep him in the basement. Oh. See, he was like locked up. Well, he was metaphorically locked up in the basement.
Oh,
and she was at first annoyed that who told you she had a secret talented person working in the basement. And then we finally had to convince her. I said, well, Keith Haring is his best friend. And he said, we should come here. And he's in the basement. Finally, she opened the door. And we went down these steep wooden stairs. And there he was. A painting which is now in our collection, Bird
and
Money.
Yeah, I just saw it.
Yeah, that painting was in that basement.
So at the time, it was $1,500, but you start working already. You're a doctor already. So you make enough money. You can buy several artists, not just one.
Well, that was our problem.
Yes,
we never stopped at one.
No.
Let's see if I
can buy all together like 5-10 paintings.
It's even worse than that in some cases. I think Keith, we got up to 85 pieces.
85 pieces. You're a little bit greedy, you know?
No, we're just not too small.
No. I think what happens is they were relationships and the artist kept growing. I wouldn't say it was never philanthropic. Mm. It was we were
it
so
was greedy. Yeah.
Not greedy. No, it's not greedy. It was exciting to be
of course it is
following
exciting.
The artist.
And
the other thing is every time we went to the studio, we saw something fresh and something new and we couldn't resist it. Like one time we saw something that we put on the roof of our car to take it back home. He said, take it out
this
because
was
I don't
have to carry days.
No, but also that he wanted more space in the studio. He had this tiny little space and, you know, he said, oh, take it, please. I'll just make more room in my studio.
He must be very sad when he passed away.
Yeah,
oh, is he very close to you?
Very.
Very, very. He invited his family and a few closest friends to be in his apartment in New York the night he died. And we were there. Yeah. In fact,
he already knew that the following day.
You have to take it back a few. So he found out in the fall, a few months before, that he was sick. For a young person,
in the 30s. Yeah.
Not 30. He was
20. He died at 29. Actually,
29.
So Keith called us up and said, "I'm. It looks like I'm going to die."
Well, no, he invited us to lunch, the whole family to lunch.
And he insisted on treating us.
He insisted on treating us. When an artist pays for lunch, you know he's going
to
die.
You have to be suspicious. Yeah. You have to be suspicious. So we're having lunch with him, and he says, I'm organizing a trip to Düsseldorf to celebrate with my dear friends my life's work. I said, life's work? He says, yes, it looks like I'm going to, you know, I'm going to die very shortly. But he spoke like a person that lived a long time. He spoke like this old wise man who was not afraid of death. He was ready to step into the next world, so to speak.
There's a story that follows that. That same day we were all sitting, and he was in his bedroom and we were in
this
the
night
room.
The night before he passed died. Away in the morning.
And
he asked
if I could come into his room. And I came in and he said, tomorrow morning at 5 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to wrap myself in a sheet, take my Leger and get it pointed upwards. And sure enough, at 5 o'clock the next morning, he died. And We never found out what happened with the Legere.
Except for, wait, a few months ago, there's a book that just came out on Keith Haring, and the writer interviewed us, and we told him the story, and he said, he was working on this book for a few years now, and right before the book went into press, he called to say that, you won't believe this, but I finally found out where the Legere is.
I was so disappointed.
The Legere. They couldn't find the Legere.
Because I was hoping we would go
he
up
really
to heaven.
Take yes. He did take it.
Wow.
I can't.
No, are you okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
Are you okay?
Yeah, his back.
Sorry, audience. Don got very excited, has been playing tennis every day in the summer, and he pulled his back. So to sit here, to go through this podcast is tough.
But Pearl, nothing is too tough.
So the era of the 80s to the early 90s, in 92 you moved to Miami, right?
92.
Right.
Yeah. Why did you choose Miami then? Because the 80s must be so exciting in the New York art scene.
Well, you're talking about the 80s, the 90s, and fast forward. Fast forward, the parents are living...
I have to answer the question.
Well, I'm going to tell you. Fast forward, the parents are living in Miami. We're spending some time, more time here. And there were some opportunities here that didn't exist in New York. Because at that moment in time, I became focused on real estate. And when I discovered South Beach, it was extraordinary. It was like empty building one after the other that you
It was just empty.
Yes, empty buildings, abandoned, you know, just like shut down buildings, and it was a challenge because it was something that, like all this Art Deco, that was just sitting here.
Yeah. So yeah.
So I, and because I was at that moment involved in real estate, I saw an opportunity, and then, you know, Don continued to practice medicine. I became focused on real estate in Miami.
So you actually.
And then my children joined me. And then Don, after retire, joined me.
Don has to come to find you.
We follow each other.
They all ran away. What could I do?
So, my God, not just that you have an eye for art, you have an eye for real estate.
Well, anyone who, I think artists teach you this. I mean, if you spend enough time with artists, you realize that you have to go, the frontier is always in the invisible, where other people don't see it and you see it. It becomes very clear to you. And artists have taught me that. You can't always go where other people go.
You should go where the artists go always.
Yeah.
I remember we were in Beijing. You know, the first time we went there was the third or fourth ring. And then the artists moved to the fifth ring, yeah. The sixth ring. And by the time we were there the last time, I think they were in the seventh ring.
Think of how many rings we had to go to chase the artists. But that's where the opportunity lies.
But
and
the thing
we learned a lot from the artists.
But when we talk about...
And the galleries, by the
galleries,
way.
Galleries, yeah.
The artists follow the galleries and the galleries. And, you know, collectors, if you pay attention, you have something to learn from it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But when you look at how you came here... is another risk of doing a property, right? To find a place, find a city.
We're not enough to realize it's a risk.
You just feel it, and then you
we
saw
it.
It
and we yeah. saw it, and we believed it.
You believe it.
Well, I think the scale was here. New York City, we lived in, you know, we were in New York for 30 years before we got down here. And, I mean, our married life was in New York for a good 30 years. And the scale of New York made things seem out of reach. I think that's one of the reasons why artists always go to the frontiers, because it's doable. And I became totally infatuated with South Beach. And then, of course, Don, you know, my whole family realized, wow, this is incredible. You can just pick off build. I'm just sorry we didn't do more, because the opportunity was there. It's just that the our commitment and invest and paying for art always
limit yourself. Limited.
Exactly. But if it wasn't for the art, God knows how many
but it's true because
more we would have done. But we can't regret it.
But the
it.
Art is yeah, much yeah. better than the building.
But every time, listen, every time we regret not owning this building that we could have, or that building we could have, We said, well, wait a minute, but that's the reason why we have a Sesame Brown. That's the reason we have a Kiefer or, you know, any one of the artists.
But it's true, because when you think about the 90s and all of a sudden Versace, all these fashion designer, musician, they all started in the 90s talking about Miami.
Well, it was a very dynamic place here. The modeling industry, again, artists, you know, this in this case, it was the modeling industry, the fashion industry. They fell in love with the visuals of this place because it was both a paradise, but it was a kind of a paradise in disrepair. It was kind of happy but sad, because you saw this magnificent architecture, and the buildings were boarded up. So it created an exciting backdrop for fashion to stage exciting events.
And I recently read that the Art Basel Miami Beach is because, Mira, you were pushing for to have the Art Basel Miami Beach.
I can't take all the credit myself, but I
you were very aggressive.
But interestingly enough, Jason gave the final inspiration that closed the deal, because we're all sitting with the Art Basel people on Lincoln Road, and at that time it was Lorenzo Rudolph, who actually, you know, and it was Sam was the creative director, but Lorenzo said, listen, at the end of the day, there, even at that time, he said, there's so many art fairs. And that day, he thought there were a lot of art fairs. You can imagine what he think about today. He said, there were the art fair here and there. Why should this be so, you know, why are people going to come here? So Jason said, and we're sitting at Rosanelle on Lincoln Road having a plate of pasta. And Jason said, you know, he said, if you put the galleries on the sand, on the beach, it'll be the first art fair that's on the beach.
And he said, well, how can we do that? And he pointed to the container boat, the boats carrying containers.
Yes.
He said, use the containers, and they could do it that way.
Yeah, so put containers. So I don't know if the first Art Basels actually had containers on the beach, on the sand, and each gallery had a container with air conditioning.
Oh, that's wild.
It was great.
So, I love it. Yes. This is much better than
so he said, well, I don't think people I don't think we can put it. Picasso. I don't think we could put Picassos in these containers. He said, you know what? We'll put the Picassos in the art in the convention center. And we'll give the galleries, the young galleries, will each have a container. So you had containers with the young art, with people sitting with umbrellas outside. Do you remember that?
I remember when I used to visit, there was one session of the Art Basel was in the containers.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
And it was the most popular, so they had to do away with it.
By the way, coincidentally, the sculpture that's in this room came out of one of those containers.
Containers?
Yes.
What a dream, because I just read and I was told that without you pushing, without the Rubels pushing,
actually, the most difficult part was not even convincing Art Basel. We had to convince the city that
because they had another fair here, which was coming here over the years, but of course it didn't have the prestige of Art Basel. And we had to take, talking about forcefulness, we at some point organized commissioners and the mayor of Miami Beach to go to Art Basel for them to experience
You're really the godmother of Art Basel, Miami Beach, to Rubens.
But then it took a whole village. Then a lot of the community really championed around Art Basel.
Because in Miami at that time, it's like Hong Kong before.
Yeah.
They didn't understand
right.
what an art fair could bring, you know, the tourism, the people. They have no idea. So it must be like Miami as well.
So did you champion the Hong Kong?
I didn't. They just chose at the time. I think at the time they wanted Asia. So when Art Basel wanted Asia, there was Hong Kong, there was already Art Fair.
Well, we had gone to Shanghai. We went to the first fair, but it wasn't Art Basel.
Yeah,
the Shanghai.
That wasn't Basel.
Lorenzo,
that
was, by the way. I think it was Lorenzo.
Lorenzo left Art Basel to
and
do
went,
it.
Yes.
But when Art Basel came to Hong Kong, they choose Hong Kong because Hong Kong is a perfect infrastructure. There is no import tax. There's no import duties. There's no VAT. And it's free. So, I mean, there's no censorship. So it was a perfect place. But then there was this art fair. So they went and bought this art fair.
But, you know, but when you talk about Asia, you cannot talk about Asia and art without talking about your living room.
My living room,
Is it a living room or a dining room? I don't know.
It was a living room. There's also a dining room.
What's the size of that table?
I can sit 66 people.
66 people. So you can't really...
Hungry people at this rate.
No, 66 but, is not 80.
You
66.
Haven't been to Asia, and you haven't experienced art in Asia, and you haven't experienced the vitality of art in Asia without being at that table with all the people that you invite and feed the most exotic, amazing food.
You still have the hands with the dish. I'm still waiting for you to bring your granddaughters, another generation to come.
Well, right. He has one more year till his Chinese is fluent enough. He's only 12.
When
he gets to 13, we'll be able to bring
him. You know what? It will be fantastic if you can bring your grandson seeing Chinese instead of just going to a Chinese restaurant to speak Chinese.
But seriously, we might leave him there with you.
Seriously, Pearl, your dining room sets the tone to the hospitality and to the kind of dialogue where East meets West and the kind of the way it all opened up.
Thank you.
Also, you were one of the first gallerists. I mean, at one time, we went to all the studios, but the artists did not have gallery representation. That was very late.
That was really early because I remember your first China trip.
There were no galleries.
You were brought there by Zhang Wang, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And going around, that was in 1990s.
Yes.
Early 1990s.
Right.
Yeah.
1990s. It was, early 2000.
Maybe
1990s.
Actually, no, I think 2000.
Oh, no, it was 2001. I'll tell you why. Because we were all in we were in the lobby of a hotel when the Twin Towers came down.
Yeah, because
and we were all in shock then.
To America because of the Inside Out show, 1998.
Yes, exactly.
And then she was going through a very tough time until he met you all. You saved him and made his career global. I hear all the artists complimenting you. I was recently in Ghana. I met with Amoko Bovo. And of course, the rebels are mentioned.
We appreciate that. It may or may not be true.
That was magical. Amoko did the most extraordinary residency with us, and the rest is history. That's all we can know. You know, we fell in love with the art. We show the art, and the rest, you know. But were you the first gallery?
No. We have Courtyard Gallery, and we have Shang Art from Lawrence.
Okay, so
these are the early galleries. Very early galleries. So Shanghai, we have Shang Art. Lawrence has done a great job. And then Beijing, you have the Courtyard Gallery. And at the time, it was Karen Smith. And then later on, it was Mark Marjo. These are the early galleries.
What I liked about our experience with you is that you aren't just, of course, you were eager to show your own art, the art that you were already exhibiting. But what's so exciting is that you were so open to go into all these studios and see. You were looking at the art at the same time, for the first time as we were. Yeah. So it was.
By the way, for all the audience to know is around 10 years ago or more than 10 years ago, the Rubel family was with me. We went to a 10 days or 2 weeks trip around China.
In a van. And airplanes too. We took planes.
Airplanes, van. My God, we went to all these other places.
We did everything but walk.
And then the best story was that we were in the car. So after the studio. So we have father, mother, son, daughter-in-law, we were all inside the car. They were discussing about which artists and everything. So we have the mother and the son together. and keep on telling the father, no, that's a whole negotiation. Because apparently Rubel family collection must have all the members agree to collect certain artists, right?
Yes, and it has to be a consensus. And I can't even imagine what would happen if we didn't have that, you know, those limitations. I mean, we'd have to have...
It's very Freudian because... My wife always sides with my son.
Always, I can
see that's not true.
We were laughing at the back, and we all didn't say anything. We said, "Ooh, well, there's always two against one."
Well, I'm very stubborn. So
very stubborn. The funny thing is that Jason is always on the side of. He's much more conservative. It's just the opposite of what you expect. He's much more conservative because neither one of us has had an art education. I mean, we've read all these books, but we don't have a formal education.
But Jason
does. Jennifer has an art education. And I come from a talented family. My father was an artist. My sister's an artist. I mean, so we come from a talented family, but we never, the two of us.
It's not academic.
It's not. So Jason really brings a kind of much more academic point of view to
this. Historical.
Historical. Not academic, historical. By the way, Jason did Keith Haring's last interview in Arts Magazine.
Ooh, amazing.
Just as a beautiful interview.
Amazing. And Jennifer is an artist.
Is an artist, too. Yeah. And Jennifer excludes herself from collecting. She says, you can't be an artist and be a collector. Well, you can, but she finds that she's too critical.
But it was... quite a journey because we eat, we all love food.
Oh my God, do you remember when we went to the market and first we picked out all the fish?
Yeah.
And then you picked out the restaurant
that cooked the fish.
So in this market, you pick the fish, you take a basket, you literally are in the fish market.
Yeah.
So we select the fish. Yeah. And then you select the restaurant that makes it.
And then they send it to the restaurant to cook for us.
And it was the best fish we've had.
Oh, my God. That was incredible. It was incredible. Where was that?
Hong Kong. That was Hong Kong. I smuggled you out during one lunch. And I said, we have to go and eat.
We had some incredible meals. What about the time that we came to this, the driver, we were starving. We didn't know where to eat. And the driver said, no problem. I'll take you to my family. And we arrive, and then we arrive.
In a very simple place.
Very simple place. Where they're cooking, they're using eggshells for fuel. I didn't even know eggshells. It was crazy.
And the food also was good. I don't think we had a bad meal in China.
It was incredible. No. We had incredible food.
But the best thing about the both of you, your whole family, you guys were adventurous. You're not choosy about food. We can eat on the street to any restaurant as long as it's good.
It was really special. It was really the whole experience of you were so open to discovering artists together with us.
It wasn't like you were taking us.
No, but you weren't just taking us to artists that you knew. How did we come up with a
plan? You gave us a list.
How did you get that? Don did all this research.
Jason was doing research. You were doing research.
And then we gave you a list.
You gave me a list and we just make all the appointments.
But
the studio.
But the most exciting visit was to Zhu Xianji.
That was unbelievable. It was very cold.
It was February at that time, and it was cold.
At Jujing Shiwan, I wasn't there. I saw you in Singapore. You were asking me, where is some young emerging artist? And I said, okay, emerging artist doesn't need to be limited by age.
Right.
Okay, I'm going to send you some old emerging artists. And when you arrive, and I send Xiaoming to meet up with you and to bring you to all those artists, and then you love the Jujing Shi.
Oh my God, we walked
in. And Jujing Shi, again, always thank you. Because without his work shown during Art Basel Miami at your museum, he would never have.
You know, those paintings, each painting is 800 pounds. Okay, that's one of three panels.
He would
each
never
panel.
Be able to do those 6 meters, baby.
How did
you
are
he the
do
only
it?
One who can do it.
That arrived safely in America is a miracle. You did some job packing it up, but those pieces are now they hang permanently in our space because
you can't move it.
You cannot. No, heavy. But you don't want to move it because first of all, the way the paint hangs on the canvas, it requires an ongoing life because he likes the dripping. He likes the changing. He likes the changing. So to move it would be dangerous on the life of this painting. And people are always blown away by the magic. The paint still has that smell of paint. It's still, you can feel it.
But it's interesting. He was both the youngest artist and the oldest artist in the exhibition.
Yeah.
Because in spirit, he was the youngest
artist. Well, we did it. So we ended up doing a show of 28 Chinese. And
that Chinese show that went around different museums, right?
It was at the Asian Society in San Francisco. It was in Texas. It's been, it's really traveled. People really were intrigued to learn about art from China.
Okay, so one question I really need to ask you is, you start with American art, artists in America. Since when did you start looking at, all over, global artists? When you were in Cologne, you always go to a Cologne art fair.
Yes.
So do you actually go to artist studio? Because right next to us is Dusseldorf, right?
Yes. Besides, what you're looking at is Thomas Roof from 1988. Yeah.
So at the time you were...
We were in his... Okay, we met him at a dinner. I think it was Thomas Schutte's dinner.
Okay.
And it was an opening for Thomas Schutte. We meet Thomas Roof, and we said, well, what do you make? He says, I make these outrageously big...
Are you forgetting the backstory?
What was the backstory?
What happened is I'd read a book about a man who sat for...
A portrait.
For a portrait by... Giacometti. And it was so painful. He had 27 sittings and he wasn't able to move. So we met Thomas Roof and we said, how bad could a photographer be? That has to be faster.
Because he invited us to have a photograph taken. Yeah.
It took him 8 hours of a million photos before he was satisfied with it.
8 hours.
We thought, a photograph, we'll just go there, and we never experienced being the subject of an artwork before. So when he said, come to my studio, which was in Dusseldorf. So we went to his studio and it took 8 hours for him to do these two pictures. So you have a picture, that's me and that's Don over there.
He's very famous for having done portraits of young people.
We
were the first older people. At that time we weren't older. We were the first older. And
how old were we there?
48. 50, but the big complaint he has, he said, young people have wonderful blank faces.
And your face is... He said, give me a blank face. Give me a blank face.
I said, you're 30 years too late to get a blank face.
No, so these are as blank an expression as
blank
we can get. Yeah.
So this is 8 hours.
Eight hours.
Well, so we learned that photography can take just as much time, needs to take that time to really get it.
But I became very sympathetic for the fashion models who sit there all day waiting for these photos.
I think fashion photography is really different from art photography.
Is it?
It's different, but just saying in terms of modeling,
photographer.
In terms of being a sitting model, a model is difficult. When you think of what in history, what it took.
Sitting.
Yeah. By the way, the sitting before the photograph was a tool to create a vignette that you could paint from. Do you know? For centuries, you had to have the model actually sitting there all those hours.
As the painter.
Just as bad.
Yeah.
But in answer to your question, what happened in around 1982 is all of the European collectors came to America.
Yes.
So being like who we Saatchis are, we decided to go to Europe. If they're all coming here, we were going to go to Europe.
You know, it's funny that what Don's mentioning, because there was a time when, East Village, East Village was a place that we visited every single Sunday. Yeah. We visited studios and galleries, especially on Sunday, the galleries, they were all open on Sunday.
Not like today.
But the interesting thing is, all of a sudden, there are these collectors called Doris and
Charles Saatchi.
Charles Saatchi. everywhere we went, they bought the art. And all of a sudden, the prices went crazy. I mean, they went absolutely crazy. And no one could compete with them. It was like, oh, Jeff Koons, Richard Prince, Cindy Sherman, International with Monument. Who are these people? So Doris and Charles Saatchi, like, were the...
But it was not only them.
And the Schwartz. I mean, there were a whole group of people that came from a different collecting generation into this young generation. And we felt kind of pushed out in a way because we didn't bring the money that they brought. So we said, the hell with this. Let them. We'll give them New York, and we're going to go to Europe. So we started going to Europe.
I love that.
Well, we started going. And in Europe, the interesting thing is, in Europe, people really appreciate a young collector.
Yeah.
They respect young collectors.
Exactly.
You're not just like somebody buying young art. It's like they celebrate people that have the courage to look at young art and support young art. So we suddenly felt appreciated.
But also there's a different rhythm to European art.
Yeah, it's slower.
At that time, it's much slower. Everyone in Europe takes their time, thinks about it. And
there's not this urgency because what happened in the East Village...
It became very chaotic.
There was a rush on the art, and prices went crazy. We think it's happened in the last 10 years, but you can't imagine how wild it was at that moment in time. And so we
started in 1980s.
It was what we literally turned our back on New York because we felt like.
But also there was an untapped source of European art. I mean, for the last 15 years, everyone was looking at American art. Even people like Richter were relatively inexpensive, Richter and Polker and those.
Yeah.
So that
Did you see the Richter and Polker when you went to Germany? Because it's Germany,
No, we saw it.
No, we saw it. We saw it in Europe.
They hadn't come to America.
But there were really interesting artists in Europe, and we got to know Düsseldorf, and we got to know Berlin, and
Berlin wasn't as important, it was a bit later.
Belgium became very important too.
Belgium.
Yeah. With Luc Tuymans, Marlene Dumas.
Oh, Marlene Dumas, yeah.
You know what's interesting? We basically for us was. It was thrilling to go to places because by going to the place, we could actually experience the studios that we learned to appreciate way back when we first started is something that stayed with us. To be able to visit an artist, spend some time with them, have a meal with them, come back the next day. So the place was important. The visit to the studio was important. And
it's important that you see the culture that produced the art.
Of course,
You know, you can't understand Richter or Polker without being there.
I mean, Kiefer, I mean, to be in his studio and to understand what motivates his art, his practice, the way it's amazing. Yeah. So all these experiences, the traveling became part of our life, to actually go to a place, to actually spend that kind of time that we spent in China, visiting the artist, having a meal with the artist.
That connection.
So even it all relates to getting with a young, especially a young artist, an unknown artist, it builds a degree of faith. So it's not just a instinctual attraction to the work, but it's also it's backed up with what you're learning about the artist and the practice, the whole gestalt makes for
what
confidence.
Happened. If you like the art, you don't like the artist. Will you still collect art? Because you know, usually you know, you love the big pieces.
Mira has much more empathy than I do, so she would not collect the artist if she really didn't like it. I always figured, you know. Caravaggio was not a very nice man.
But I can't. I don't.
And a certified murderer, and I would have collected his.
But you wouldn't have known. He wouldn't have known that he was a murderer.
Yes, he did. He was always running away.
But I'm trying to think of artists that that I don't like as people. Most of the time,
I can think of them, but why insult them?
No. But I think for the most part, they get. I hate to say this, but sometimes they're always great when they're young. It's when they get older that is a problem. When they sell out, when they become a cliche of themselves, when the ego becomes so big, and the money and all of that, and they suddenly become, you know, real estate mongol.
I mean, it's hard to realize, but you know, the Jasper Johns that we love were all from his first two, three shows. Same thing with Rauschenberg. Same thing with Wesselman.
We know the artists. It's the same thing
right through to the present. The very best work they make is early.
But also, we know the artists in a very seductive, beautiful time in their careers. They're eager. They're not as confident. But they're first discovering themselves, and most of the time, they find each other, and we find them at a moment when that they break through, and it's a tender moment.
I think it's a very tender, the difference between
artists that have already achieved tremendous fame and financial success. Some of them, you don't even want to know them.
Yeah.
You may, and as a gallerist, you probably have to still represent them. But we can move away from it. We can still go back to the innocence of the young artist who is emerging.
So the first European artists that you collect, they're Germans.
Yes, Thomas Schutte, I think, was one of the first. No,
Francesco Clemente.
Francesco Clemente.
Yes, that's true. I forgot. Francesco Clemente, Thomas Schutte.
But Francesco Clemente at the time, was he living in
Italy? We met him in Italy.
Not here.
Actually, when we first visited his studio, his young daughter was actually peeing on the painting. we said, you can't do that. And he just kind of did an Italian shrug.
It's part of life, you know.
So his studio was his apartment, was his residence for the family.
Yeah, but I remember seeing these big, I think they were paperworks on the floor, and this little girl was just like, I don't know that she was peeing on it, she was like walking on it, you know what I mean? It was like a kid in a diaper or whatever. But,
it was interesting. The reason he made paper is he had gone to India before this, and he was in the southern part of India. And there was no way he can get the paintings.
Canvas back.
So he started painting on paper, and he would fold it, someone put it on their head, and walk 10 miles.
It was like sheets of paper that could be carried on the head to deliver to him, and then he found a way to join these sheets of paper into larger works. And some of the work that we have are some of the best paintings that fold up into these sheets.
So. That means that what brings you to travel around the world is the art world.
We have never gone on a vacation. Actually, American Airlines just sent me something and said we just passed 3 million miles.
Yeah.
And every one of those 3 million miles was to look at art and not to go on vacation.
Do you call that work?
By the way,
do you ever go on vacation?
No, of course not. Because I think
is this work? Is it what we're doing?
No, not at all.
No.
Oh, no. So after from our last conversation, you went to China first time it's just now you mentioned
2001.
And from then you went to China quite often, right?
But there was a reason to come back. There were reasons to come back. You were one of those reasons.
Oh, thank you.
Well, you were, because you enticed us into... We had a taste of China, right? We had a taste of China in 2001. Then you said, come, we can go.
You were looking at 15, 20 years of talent that had been making work.
And the world hadn't seen it yet.
And we were just astonished. You would take us to one place after another. And it was just an astonishing amount of talent.
You haven't been back at least, I mean, China, you haven't been back at least 7-8 years?
Yes. Yeah.
7-8 years is about time you come back.
I agree.
Do I hear a generous invitation?
Yeah, of course. You're always welcome. I really have such fun. I mean, our trip is unbelievable. It's unbelievable. The fun that we were laughing, staring at you all.
We stayed in one. Wait a minute. Do you remember we stayed in one hotel where the ceiling fell in on us?
It
was
yes,
the fanciest hotel we ever
stayed. The Jockey Club.
Yes, the Jockey Club. Yes, I got too old to stay in the Beijing in a Jockey Club.
We stayed in these real dumps.
No ceiling ever fell in on us except this fancy hotel.
The
fanciest hotel, the Jockey Club, the ceiling fell in on us. That was the funniest thing. You said, oh, I want to treat you to this great hotel. And then the ceiling falls in.
Yeah, we were so embarrassed, we didn't want to tell you that. We had to tell the manager that it'd be a good idea if you get us out of this room.
We were lucky to escape that room alive.
Luckily that you're unharmed.
We were literally, the bed was on one side of the room and the ceiling fell in on the other. And this was the fanciest hotel we stayed. Were you with us when we went up the mountain on the to the
Buddhist mountain?
The Buddhist mountain, where I was.
Mirig wasn't able to breathe.
Yes.
You remember the altitude sickness? And the elevator, they shut down the elevator. They didn't have an elevator operator. And you brought the chief monk to help me figure out how to breathe to survive the night.
But he said it happened to a lot of people, so he gave her oxygen.
Yes, you need to have fresh oxygen because of the altitude problem.
Yeah. But why did we go there? Because did they make art, those monks? Or
no,
was that just
an
adventure?
We went
just
there
to see the mountain.
Just as an
to
adventure.
See, yeah, because you have to see things.
It was incredible.
You have to see things to relate
it
about the
amazing.
Environment, to learn.
But we took this elevator. It was an outdoor elevator. It took us, 5,000 feet in the air.
Well, 5,000 meters was
meters. Well, I don't, and I was fine. And then just.
And as soon as you walked out,
yeah, but then the elevator shut down and they couldn't take me down. It was crazy. But this.
But I think China's coming due again. Yeah. I think that, there was a tremendous enthusiasm over Chinese artists, but because of other reasons in the last 5 or 10 years, there hasn't been as much cross fertilization.
I think
talent, I'm sure, is there.
I think politics has gotten in the way. The truth of the matter is that we found the Chinese people to be as gracious, as engaged.
Amazing
and
people.
Amazingly, they love Americans. We never visited a place in the world that loved Americans
because
more.
Like shows that you created, that create the platform for cultural dialogue. What is important is a
that
cultural
that we share, we have more in common than we don't. I mean, the food we shared, the conversation we had, they were generous, they were loving. They're very hardworking people. We fell in love.
And in China, the difference then from the West is the artist always pays to take you out.
I know that was a very
big thing. The artist always takes you out.
True.
It's only in the West that they don't.
You are so right.
Right?
Right.
Every single artist has to take you out.
You were absolutely right. I
so
remember
this is
sitting
very
at this
different.
Huge, like these huge round tables, and one of them was Ai Weiwei. And it's true, they insist on
paying and insist on treating.
This is true, though. This is a tradition that has to come to America.
The interesting thing is, we didn't have a language exchange, but we always felt that China and the United States had more in common than almost any places in the world.
Absolutely.
And this was it's a shocking realization. I mean, it's the same type of energy. It's the same type of ambition.
The focus on family.
Yes,
the
family
work,
values.
Education.
These are all values. I mean, I would say that the connection to the average Chinese person was so positive. I mean, we felt a real connection. And I'm sorry that the politics, I mean, we never focused on politics. We never thought about politics. We never thought about any politics involved. But the actual person, we have more in common with the Chinese people than ever expected.
I think very different is, I think the both of you would connect with people from the low to the high. And that's very special. Because you're in art world, you have low to high, you don't have this discrimination, you don't have that. And so you really get to know the people.
I'm looking forward to going back to China.
You should, because it's a complete different
thing.
Well,
we got a very special invitation from Pearl Lam. This is not
to.
Every day you get an invitation from Pearl Lam. Will you have enough people to seat at that table when we come?
Yeah, I will give you a huge party. I think when you arrive, all the artists will be flying in.
Oh, that would be
they
very
will
special.
Be flying. I doubt, but and the right. younger artist is very different today as well.
What's different?
Because they have education. Because the older generation, like 60s and those, they didn't, many of those, they haven't even, they stopped studying when the age mm-hmm. of 16 or 18, I mean 16 basically, because they're sent to factories. And now in the 40s, and those in the 40s, they have the education, some of them sent abroad. But this generation, they have nothing to worry. There's no politics to worry, nothing to worry about food. They're very confident.
Confident because they're more
is the confidence
secure?
Justified?
And are they actually, is there a market for their work?
Now they're getting worried because when they're coming out, there was still a market. Now there's no market.
That's true all over the world.
So you have
right
to
now.
See how they survive.
But that's true all over now.
Of course, but the difference is China, because of that one-child policy, you have all the parents, grandparents, everybody supporting. It's not like the older generation. The older generation doesn't have that support. So they're really hungry to make that success. The younger generation is less of that.
Because you think that they're spoiled by families because they're the only child.
They're the only child.
Yeah, interesting.
They're less, you know.
But it's changed, right?
Changed, but some of them is. I mean, some of them is very talented. I mean, yeah. I know one artist who is trying to merge technology and art, was using those VR glasses and did things in VR and taking that aesthetic and put it in paintings and in sculptures. It's really interesting.
Is that where you think, I can never generalize, but you think that Chinese artists are looking to merge technology?
Oh, no.
There's a group. There's a subgroup.
China is so big.
So big.
So everyone is developing in a different way. And also the syllabus has changed. Before and now the syllabus in the Chinese academy, they have taken from the West. It's more Western syllabus.
Even in CAA?
CAA, definitely.
Really?
Definitely, because you have a lot of foreigners, lecturers coming to teach.
They were very traditional when we were there.
You know, when we came with Jean Wan, this is in 2001, we went to a university city.
Chengdu.
They invited us, right? We're having lunch with the professors, and they said, oh, I feel so selfish having a lunch alone with you. Can you come and visit some of my students? So we said, sure. Come to the campus in an hour, 2 o'clock, which was like an hour away, an hour later. We come, we arrive on the campus, and he gathered an entire auditorium.
Oh, no!
2,000 students to meet us.
Wow!
So this was with Jean Wan at the time. And so we got on stage, and no one could speak any English, of course. And
more importantly, we could not speak Chinese.
So
did anybody do translation?
Somebody started translating. And I said to and Jennifer was with us then.
Oh.
I said, you know, I don't know what we can talk about because, I mean, do they know Andy Warhol? Do they know Jean-Michel Basquiat?
They knew everything.
Wait a minute. You can't believe this, but... So they put on the board, they wrote Andy Warhol. Everybody raised their hand, they knew Andy Warhol. Everybody knew Jean-Michel Basquiat. Then we would put down Richard Prince, put down every artist we put on the board, and they translated who it was.
So
they knew
impressive.
Everybody. It was the most sophisticated art audience. This is in 2001. Those kids, because of the internet, these 2,000 kids, because of the internet,
Knew everything.
They were more sophisticated. And I always tell this to students that come to us now from all, you know, from schools, high schools, colleges. They're not as informed as these Chinese kids were.
Hey, at the time
they're
too,
so
I don't
informed.
Know if it's still
and they are
true.
Hungry for knowledge.
Knowledge.
Well.
Yeah. They are searching
very
the internet.
For knowledge.
They knew artists that were having a show that month. In Chelsea.
You see, now CAA, I think even 10 years ago or 10 years ago, they start adopting. They have French, they have the French Academy. They came in with their syllabus. They're taking all over the world syllabus. So when you see the artists today, they are much more conceptual. It was inevitable.
It was inevitable. Yeah, if you study hard enough, you're going to get to the edge of the envelope.
I'll never forget. I'm always talking about these 2,000 students in China.
It's amazing.
Who are more informed about American art.
It's different because they were hungry.
Do you think today it's not the same?
I don't know. I feel that they do know, but they are more like the artists in the West than good old days. Yeah. Good old days is because it's not open, you don't travel
you're
so
hungry
much.
To learn.
They're hungry and hungry and hungry. And you have a foreigner, bait collectors coming in. They want to learn. They want to know what is outside.
We enjoyed our time in China, and we have to take you up on your offer.
Yeah, please. Please. And then we will go to other places as well. I mean, all those 60 years of your marriage, 60 years of adventure, art adventure.
Definitely art adventure, yeah.
On this note, I want to thank you, Dawn and Mira, for joining me on this podcast, and I'm waiting for you in China.
We're ready.
You're ready. Ready and willing.
And I see you next month in Paris.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.